I'm Indy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Last year, Christy Lawrence joined us on the program to talk about Cape Cod native Thornton Burgess, a prolific 20th century children's author and conservationist. During the discussion of her book, Nature's Ambassador, The Legacy of Thornton Burgess, we only touched on the role Burgess played in pioneering the use of radio to promote science and conservation. And we promised we'd have her back to delve further into this aspect of Thornton Burgess's legacy. Christy Lawrence joins us in our Woods Hole studios once again. Good morning, Christy.
Good morning, Mindy.
And joining us on the phone from Washington, D.C., Marcel LaFollette, a historian whose research and writing examines the history of science with emphasis on its communication and popularization. She has a research appointment at the Smithsonian Institution Archives, and her most recent books include Science on American Television and A History and Science on the Air, Popularizers and Personalities on Radio and Early Television. Welcome to the program, Marcel.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
So technology, very much part of our everyday lives. We tend to forget that radio was cutting-edge technology in the early 20th century. Marcel, can you describe the transformation radio had on American culture during that time?
Well, one of the great radio historians describes it as almost like an epidemic. People became fascinated with the medium. They began acquiring the material to develop, to build their own sets. It was just something that people had not experienced before. You could turn on a dial and someone would appear, at least their voice, in your living room. And that revolutionized how people were learning about the world, learning about popular entertainment, and learning about what was happening in politics and the world around them.
Yeah. Austin Clark, a scientist at the Smithsonian Institution, was one of the first to bring scientists to the radio airwaves. Marcel, tell us more about how he came to this idea.
Well, he was a pretty interesting character because he was always looking around for something new to do and willing to experiment. He had been at the Smithsonian for quite a few years. He's a Massachusetts native and had moved to Washington in 1909. And by 1923, he was a curator at what would later become the Museum of Natural History. And he was perhaps a little bit frustrated in his career. And when a request came to the secretary of the Smithsonian, the head of the Smithsonian Institution, to appear on a local radio station, that request sort of was passed on down the line, various assistant secretaries, I think, declined, and Austin Clark jumped at the chance to try out appearing on a new medium. For him, this was wonderful because he very quickly heard the next day from friends, neighbors who had happened to listen to him on the air, and you can imagine it was a way to achieve celebrity, but also perhaps to bring the science that he loved to a more popular audience.
And luckily it landed in his lap, because who knows what would have happened had it been somebody else behind that microphone.
Yes.
So describe the format that Austin Clark used initially when bringing Smithsonian scientists to the airwaves.
Well, he was also a fairly austere and formal chap, and so he required his guests, who were all eminent scientists, initially at the Smithsonian and then at local institutions like the Carnegie Institution, to wear formal dress, that what we'd call today black tie, because he felt that if they were dressed formally, then they would speak more formally on the air, and he would sort of coddle them carefully, work with them on what they were going to say on the air. So everything was scripted, but it was also live. So he had to be sure that someone wouldn't come up to the microphone and, let's say, at least faint or be a little nervous.
Right. And so radio at the time, as you're mentioning, was live. There aren't any recordings, unfortunately, of these early scientific radio lectures.
No.
But the scripts we have do reveal that the radio lectures are rather dry. So, Marcel, what were some of the topics that they covered?
They were very dry. The first titles were things like the National Herbarium or the Astrophysical Observatory. But by the next spring, so he had begun this series in the fall. By the next spring, he had gotten the idea and was starting to title things like The Giants of the Animal World, or Shooting Stars and What They Are, or Animal Terrors of the Past Ages, Dinosaurs. And of course, we know dinosaurs are always a topic of interest. Fortunately, we can read the scripts. They're rather standard scientific talks with more definitions and the kind of thing we might expect to see in high quality newspaper today.
Right. And you mentioned that Austin Clark had to push the scientists to use layman terms during the broadcast. And this is something journalists still struggle with today when covering science, how to make it understandable to a non-scientific audience.
Yes, but also acceptable to the scientific community. And at that point, in the 1920s, you still have a great deal of resistance among the community, among major prominent scientists, to appearing in public at all. Not even in a public lecture. And so to persuade people to appear on this new medium of radio in which 15 minutes later there might be a popular singer and 15 minutes before there might have been a band playing, to persuade scientists to appear on the radio was to persuade them to do something that they were not always very comfortable doing. And I think in that respect, Austin Clark and the other people who were entrepreneurial popularizers at the time were very important in changing the attitudes within the scientific community.
Yeah. Christy, in addition to being a children's author, Thornton Burgess also had a syndicated newspaper column, and at some point he started reading the column on the radio. So how did Thornton Burgess make this initial leap into radio?
It was an invitation from the Westinghouse studio in Newark, New Jersey, to simply read his story. That early radio programming, there was very little at the time. I think there were 2 days that were available, and Howard Garris, who wrote the Uncle Wiggily stories, also had a small time slot. But it only began by reading the stories. The program caught on. There was interest in it. And so he was asked to begin telling a little bit more about the particular animals described in his children's stories. And so there came to be a natural science component to it.
So he starts the Radio Nature League. And Christy, tell us more about this weekly broadcast. This caught on.
This definitely caught on. And I think the idea had been germinating with him for a while after the initial success of his program and the relating of natural science. The idea of having a club in the early 1920s was appealing to him. And so in late 1924, he proposed this on the air and said he might come up with something a little bit more formal in early 1925, which he did. And he said, if there's validation of this idea, if we get enough interest within by the next program, I'll go with it, with this Radio Nature League idea. Well, thousands of people responded to it from a number of states, and so he definitely had the validation that he wanted. In terms of the success of the program, it's quite clear. There was a Christian Science Monitor article, February 18, 1925, so 90 mm-hmm. years ago. And it begins, in less than 3 weeks, radio has enlisted more than 20,000 members in a Radio Nature League whose sole aim is to assist in the preservation and conservation of all desirable wildlife in America. This humanitarian idea first came to Thornton W. Burgess, nationally famous naturalist lecturer and writer of stories for children, who enlisted the services of Westinghouse station WBZ. And it goes on to say 39 states of the Union are represented in the recently formed league, and members have been enlisted from England, Bermuda, and many of the Canadian provinces.
That's amazing. So when Burgess did what he did with the Radio Nature League was innovative for its time. He engaged the audience by asking them questions on the air, reading their letters, and encouraging them to perform tasks. And this appealed to both children and adults.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
And I love, you've got a letter here of somebody, this letter right here where somebody's talking about a woodcock, but I love the way they signed it. What is it, yours?
Yours for the love of the little feathered folks, Thornton W. Burgess. Always promoting.
Yeah, always promoting.
Yeah.
So listeners sent him all manner of life forms. Arriving at the radio studios were both dead and live specimens that people hoped to have identified. Glad I didn't work in that mailroom.
Mm. Yeah. Austin Clark fit in so beautifully here. because in identifying these creatures, Austin Clark was a phenomenal resource for Thornton Burgess.
Yeah. So, Marcel, let's ask you that. Austin Clark and Thornton Burgess eventually get connected. How did that happen?
Well, yes, let's get to that because that's sort of what brought Christy and me together.
Yep, right.
And I think they really, the two men had formed almost within a matter of days a really remarkable friendship, which lasted pretty much all their lives. And Austin wrote to Thornton Burgess, having heard of him, because Austin had five children, but not knowing of Thornton Burgess's existing radio program. So Austin's all rather full of himself, saying, I have this radio program in Washington, and perhaps you might like to appear on it at some point. And Thornton Burgess writes back immediately and says, well, this is wonderful, and by the way, I have a radio program, and I've created something called the Radio Nature League. Well, then Austin writes back. These were in the days when people would write sometimes even two letters a day, and the mail service would have two deliveries. So they're engaged, much as we might engage enthusiastically by email today with someone new. And Austin Clark is saying things like, encouraging Burgess, saying, you're no more of a crank on the sending end of radio than I am. They see each other as pioneers. They're not cranks the way perhaps some of their colleagues regarded them. And the opportunities presented by the Radio Nature League, which if you think about it, is not that different from what Mr. Wizard and people on television did later with their science clubs, that gave Austin Clark an opportunity to reach out to a new audience. And then part of the mission of the Smithsonian is to answer questions from interested members of the public. And when Thornton Burgess then began sending those queries on and the squashed specimens.
The corpses.
Austin Clark could not only sometimes answer the questions himself, but he had access to the premier experts on that particular insect, that particular perhaps the bird that the feather came from, and the letters reflect this extraordinary expertise that he's tapping into and then sending on to Burgess to be able to answer the letters of an ordinary person on the air.
Yeah. So this is an important connection then, Burgess, to Austin Clark, because then, as you're saying, it gives him access to these scientists at the Smithsonian. They're answering the questions that the readers are sending in and really helping boost the Radio Nature League to the next level.
I think what was phenomenal about this, Marcel, was the ability of Austin Clark to be providing Thornton Burgess with this pristine scientific information that he absolutely loved. But that information was being passed on to children, to a listening audience who was accessing radio for the first time. Many people were apologizing to Thornton Burgess, oh, I'm sorry I didn't get a radio earlier. Mm-hmm. And so this was truly in the very early days. But the caliber of information, because of Austin Clark, among others, but it was primarily this extraordinary relationship that provided radio audiences with amazing information, scientific, hardcore scientific information.
Well, it both helped to authenticate the seriousness and the accuracy of whatever Thornton Burgess was saying. So that meant parents could trust Thornton when he was telling them about nature.
That's right.
About nature. Mm-hmm. But it also validated Thornton Burgess's own role as a popularizer.
And a naturalist, was tremendously important to him.
Yes, and Austin, I mean, what amazed me immediately was that Austin treated Burgess as a colleague and brought him into the fold, introducing him to people, fellow scientists in the Boston area. And in every letter, he doesn't just talk about snowy owls. He gives the scientific name for snowy owls or for whatever specimen that's been sent in.
All right, Chrissy, well, you picked up a letter there. What have you got?
I was looking through the files, and here's this letter from Burgess Radio Nature League, Westinghouse, September 24, 1928, to Austin Clark. And it's just so typical of the letters that that I used in writing this that Marcel referenced. And it begins, "Thanks for your good letter. I suspect that these might be the European house cricket, but not being familiar with it, I did not dare say so. Those were sent to me from Springfield, Mass," so on and so forth. He said, "I should have sent you those caterpillars. I found out by experience it's practically impossible to identify anything in the insect line from mere descriptions. For that matter, it is impossible to identify birds more than once in a blue moon." And then so on. But he's talking about the caterpillar being rather distinctive, being all hairy and all yellow, with two tufts at the forward end. But as Marcel said, the exchanges, not so much in this, the letter goes on for another three paragraphs, but the exchange of the scientific names of very detailed information that a two naturalists would exchange with each other.
Yeah. Fascinating, yeah.
Mm-hmm. But Christy, I thought you were going to mention the bed bugs.
Oh, yes.
All right, now we got to hear that story. What is it, Marcel?
Well, that's one where we have Burgess's initial letter, just saying here's another specimen, and then Austin Clark writes back and says, "Oop, here's the bad news." and then Burgess wrote back, "I am just in receipt of your letter identifying the bug I sent you. I strongly suspected that this was a bed bug and told my secretary so, but not being an expert, I decided to send it to you. Not trouble me in the slightest to pass on the information, because I can quite boldly and fearlessly state that I have encountered them in a variety of some places where they had no business to be." Great sense of humor.
Yeah.
We're talking about pioneers in science education and broadcasting with Marcel LaFollette and Christy Lawrence. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about pioneers in science education broadcasting with Christy Lawrence, author of Nature's Ambassador, The Legacy of Thornton Burgess, and Marcel LaFollette, who is the author of Science on American Television and A History and Science on the Air, Popularizers and Personalities on Radio and Early Television. So one of the things about Thornton Burgess is he didn't shy away from the political aspects of conservation on his program. In fact, he encouraged listeners to take action on conservation issues. And again, listeners responded. Thinking in particular the ecological damage caused by the drainage of the lake in Oregon.
Right, the Lower Klamath. He definitely used the Radio Nature League to promote conservation issues. And having William L. Finley on his program, he was a noted photographer and a state administrator out there. I can't remember his position, but Finley came on his program, was invited to describe the situation with the flooding of the Lower Klamath, which was a major flyway important conservation area. And he did. At the end of the program, Burgess said, anyone who feels that this should not happen, send a signature to me, and I will get those signatures to the Secretary of the Interior. So he did, and thousands of signatures came in. In fact, after he had sent them on, he received a letter from a woman who, the woman alone, had 1,000 signatures. So that that legislation was reconsidered 2 years later, and who knows if the Radio Nature League didn't contribute to it.
Might have happened. Then he also enlisted listeners to destroy egg masses of tent caterpillars by having a contest. Can you describe that project and the audience response?
Well, again, he utilized community, and he did that extremely well. The Boy Scouts and the Girl Scouts were specifically enlisted as projects to destroy the tent caterpillar nests, and they were counted, and the prizes were given by the Massachusetts, I think, might have been, I can't remember which state agency it was, but anyway, it was given, and there were so many nests that were destroyed that they had to do away with the contest after several years because there were no more.
There were no more, wow. Mm. Now, Austin Clark, on the other hand, avoided having his science programming touch on controversial subjects, for example, evolution. Marcel, what was his rationale and how did this reflect on the way science was debated and discussed publicly at the time?
Well, that's also part of the difference in the institutional affiliations of the two men. Austin would have been exceedingly sensitive to the fact that whenever he was on the air, he was representing the Smithsonian Institution. And the Smithsonian, which is a quasi-federal agency, and with the close political connections of many of the scientists that he knew at the time, would have especially been concerned with the discussion of evolution in the summer of 1925, which was the summer when Austin and Thornton were meeting. Yeah. That's the summer that John Scopes was put on trial in Tennessee for teaching evolution, and there were similar sort of controversies against the teaching and discussion of evolution, and including the exhibition of evolution in museums around the country. And so topics like that, and also political action of the type that Thornton Burgess was able to engage in, were the types of things that Austin couldn't do because of who he was and where he worked. But that's not to say that he didn't support the activities. Mm-hmm. And he did see and then work with Burgess in another way, and that was to gather information. Mm-hmm. To use radio as a way to ask listeners to provide their observations. You know, Cornell University and their ornithological laboratory use amateurs today to help us understand what's going on in the migrations of birds. And if any of you have been reading the newspapers lately, you know, we've been spotting snowy owls up and down the East Coast.
Oh, yeah.
Including one in Washington, D.C. Yeah. So they were using radio for similar kinds of purposes, to engage eyes and ears on the ground.
Fascinating. Two things about that. The snowy owl in 1925, thereabouts.
1927, actually. I think.
Well, I was going to say Thornton Burgess was drawing the radio audience into an evaluation of the snowy owl. Not complete agreement. Was it a noxious bird? Was it a beneficial bird? Mm-hmm. Was it eating chickens, or was it taking care of the rodent population? And Thornton Burgess deliberately asked his radio audience, "Well, what do you think? What are your experiences? Those of you who are farmers and hunters and observers out in nature, what do you think?" And this, I think this was something that was such a melding point with these two men, was their desire to use radio to benefit science. Their vision of technology as a way to enhance science. And I think it was best pointed out in Burgess's another relationship with Dr. Alfred Gross of Bowdoin College. Those two men, Burgess and Gross, met at a conference. Gross was talking about his doing a study with ruffed grouse. Mm-hmm. Parasites, they wanted to evaluate this, and they were working, I think, with someone at Cornell as well to develop this study. Burgess said, "I have a radio program. Maybe we can get people to provide specimens, hunters, other individuals." And so that study of the ruffed grouse benefited tremendously. And Gross acknowledged this, Burgess's role, through radio, mm-hmm. via the Radio Nature League.
Marcel, Austin Clark seemed to understand the importance of making the content relevant to listeners and making it entertaining and instructive, but there was pushback from the scientific community. So scientists were reticent to combine science with entertainment. Tell us why.
Well, in part because that was perceived as the route to trivialization and sensationalization of science. If you appeared within the same context as entertainment, then you were perceived to be tainted by that potentially tainted by that climate. And so that led to the resistance to write articles for popular magazines, to appear on the radio, and then we see the same kind of resistance occur later with the development of television. And even perhaps in the early days of the web, there were some scientists who were somewhat dismissive of using the web as a vehicle for public education. Mm-hmm. So whenever the new technology has that sort of taint of entertainment, the scientific community has tended to steer away from it. On the other hand, what Burgess understood brilliantly was that people wanted some what, meat with their potatoes, mm-hmm, or potatoes, mm-hmm, perhaps, mm-hmm, dessert along with the full meal. They wanted to have something to make them feel good about the science that they were learning about, and perhaps a few bits of takeaway laughter as part of their ordinary day.
Marcel, I interviewed Peter Okers at Salem State University. He teaches communications, and he devoted a semester to developing the Burgess Research League. Mm-hmm. And he was telling me that you used the word brilliant, and he said one thing that Burgess absolutely got: if you want to be successful, you appeal to your audience, and you develop your host. Mm-hmm. And Peter said Burgess did a phenomenal job at both of these. He was neighbor Burgess. He, mm-hmm, was this very approachable persona on radio. And in terms of interaction with the audience, he did that every single program.
Yeah.
Didn't he speak also, Chrissy, of like reaching out over the footlights?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The vaudevillian understanding of how a great actor, a great performer, mm-hmm, captivates the audience, makes them feel like that person in the front row or the fifth row is the only person.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That image you just used, it sounds like stage, and I was just looking over something last night. Burgess had written about audience, and he used that word. You have to come across as you're on the stage, and I thought, he was such a lecturer for such a long time, accomplished lecturer. Was he talking about that? No, because that, he always said, was the platform. So by stage, yes, he did mean. Standing in front of an audience, and what he insisted to Austin Clark was, you have to be a personality. You have, mm-hmm, to present yourself.
Right.
You can't hide behind your facts and your information, advisable as it may be to keep your credibility.
Yeah, Marcel, you write that the scientific community also seemed wary of mass media at the time. Why?
Because it was mass.
Mm-hmm.
Because there was the fear of loss of control over the message. If you spoke to your colleagues, and you spoke to your colleagues within the context of a seminar or in a journal article, then you had control of the what was said and control of the message. Once you appeared in a public forum, once you appeared on the radio, You were under the control of the people who had the switch at the station, if you will, mm-hmm, or who could arrange the program. And if you spoke to a journalist, mm-hmm, then the newspaper journalist at the time, could perhaps reshape your words, have you say, that this was the fear, have you say something in print that you didn't mean to say, or sensationalize your work, mm-hmm, in a way that you wouldn't. And there are countless. One of the wonderful things about the Smithsonian Institution archives is that they save everything, and they save all these wonderful letters and notes. And so in the records are notes that journalists were taking at the same time that they were interviewing a scientist.
Hmm.
And you can go and then read the final version. In most cases, it's fairly accurate, but sometimes Not always so.
Yeah, famous misquote, right? Yeah. I've been misquoted.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. Now, so in the very earliest days of radio, it wasn't difficult to get science programming on the air, but that began to change rapidly as radio becomes commercialized. So what was the impact of commercialization on the content and the programming?
Well, I'll let Christy speak to Burgess's experiences, but certainly in Washington, within 3 years of that first Smithsonian radio series, which was considered to be successful by the institution and by everyone who was most of the other listeners, by 1926 that one was off the air, and radio stations in Washington D.C. were becoming much more commercial. NBC and CBS networks were being formed, and there was a new formality, a new expectation. And to appear on radio at all, you were going to have to conform to that commercial context. Mm-hmm. And so programs like Austin Clark's, which were quite serious and perhaps a little dull in their lecture format, would not allow too many jokes and certainly wouldn't have any music, fell by the wayside in favor of more mm-hmm. entertainment-based programming. And Christy, you can explain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to say, what happened with Thornton?
Commercialization was the demise of his program. He actually worked for free. All that he never received any pay for his radio work, but to keep it on the air, to keep the Radio Nature League on the air, the pressure was tremendous to find sponsors, and it was difficult to do because the format was more educational than the strictly entertaining.
Mm. So, even though he was entertaining.
he definitely was, but his deeper purpose was to promote natural science. But Burgess had the added advantage and added motivation in continuing at working for free, number one, but, continuing under with scant support, and that was that he was writing books and selling books. Mm-hmm. So to have his name out there had added value for him.
Yeah. We are talking about pioneers in science education broadcasting with Christy Lawrence and Marcel LaFollette. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about pioneers in science education broadcasting with Christy Lawrence, author of Nature's Ambassador, The Legacy of Thornton Burgess, and Marcel LaFollette, who is a historian whose research and writing examines the history of science with an emphasis on communication and popularization. Her books, Science on American Television and A History and Science on the Air, Popularizers and Personalities on Radio and Early Television. So after 6 years of broadcasting the Radio Nature League, Burgess cancels the series and people are very upset. He eventually finds a commercial sponsor, Brewer & Company, but the program doesn't stay on the airwaves for long, as we're mentioning. Burgess was a pioneer, though, of personalizing the radio experience and engaging listeners. He was extremely popular. So why do you think he never went further in the networks?
Well, I'm thinking about that. It's a good question. I think his first children's book came out in 1910, and the bulk of his books were written in the teens and in the 20s. He had gotten older. I can imagine there was a piece of his personality on radio that was familiar. I think there was a desire for something new. His last sponsor was the MSPCA in Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. But I think, too, he must have just that effort. He put an enormous amount of effort into getting a television program, movies. Mm-hmm. He worked media to every extent that he could. And the national appeal, I think it's probably like other aspects of his work and his career that the tides changed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So science programming on radio did continue after the end of the Radio Nature League. Marcel, tell us more about the science service and how it took scientific education on radio to the next level.
Well, and I think the success of science services radio efforts, in particular its adventures in science, helped also provide us with an explanation, or at least a way we can sort of speculate why Burgess didn't become more popular. And I think he was there's a hint that he was perceived and characterized and marginalized because he was perceived as a speaking only to children. So that meant that later, in later years, he's the type of program that would be booted to Saturday mornings mm-hmm. or to times when children mm-hmm. would be listening. Adventures in Science, which was the most successful radio effort by Science Service, which had a nonprofit institution devoted to the popularization of science that had been created in 1921 in Washington. It was sort of Johnny on the spot again when radio was forming and had been encouraged from its beginning to try any format, any means available for communicating science. They tried movies, they tried phonograph records, so it was natural for them, in addition to print, to try radio. And Adventures in Science had a hint of dramatization to it, which was one of the secrets of success, especially by the time you get to the 1930s. It certainly had more than a whiff of personalities and celebrities to mm-hmm. it, because the goal was if you could get a Nobel laureate to appear and be interviewed by Watson Davis, who was the director of the institution then that would certainly attract an audience. But even with dramatization and with personalization and perhaps even a little bit of making things occasionally sensational, that is, programs about dinosaurs and mm-hmm. Mars and other things are always popular, a serious program, well-regarded, becomes marginalized mm-hmm. and is pushed to the edges of the schedule, not to prime time. Mm-hmm. And that happens to both to successful personalities like Thornton Burgess, but also to programs like Adventures in Science.
Mm-hmm. So as radio grows in popularity, the airwaves become increasingly chaotic with signal interference and uncertain reception. In the 1930s, the federal government steps in and creates the Federal Communications Commission. And at first glance, this would seem to be a good thing for educational broadcasting. But, Marcel, you believe it would have the opposite effect.
Well, it does, because, in fact, it doesn't really take control of what's happening. And one inadvertent influences that a lot of the educational organizations, churches, and schools sort of sold off their rights to frequencies. And as part of that whole change, there was never a specific requirement on the part of the federal government or more push on the part of the federal government to make radio include educational and informational program, so that it eventually becomes something that's perceived as public service, with the exception of what survives today is National Public Radio and other public radio stations.
Christy?
So without that push from the federal level and the regulatory level, the commercial forces were held today.
Mm-hmm. Christy?
Mindy, just to highlight what you were saying about the change in early radio and later, when Burgess started the Radio Nature League, he posed a question to his listeners. If you had the blue whale is the largest creature, the shrew is the smallest, how many shrews in weight does it take to be the equivalent of a blue whale? So he posed this question, and was absolutely stunned when the answer came from England, and his program had been heard had been heard across the ocean.
So Marcel, that you write that despite America's growing fascination with science and technology throughout the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, scientific programming continues to be only a small fraction of what broadcast on radio and then television. Why?
Deep sigh.
Oh, because it is. Predominantly commercial medium, and the perception is that science doesn't sell. Although we do know that science is popular, it requires a little bit more effort on the part sometimes of the people in charge of the commercial stations and the commercial networks to see its possibilities. And so the history, one of my challenges in both the book on radio and the book on television was not to make it too much of a depressing story. Mm-hmm. As you read at the beginning in the letters and the articles and the reports, an excitement, imaginative ideas for how the new medium could be used, and then over and over again, the story is one of commercial forces and entertainment forces pushing out entertainment and education to late at night or early in the morning, and that's of course not when the audience is there. Yeah. So it's I'd like to think that if people ask for it more, they would get it. What we do have, of course, now with electronic communication and the web are opportunities for entrepreneurs of the type that Burgess and Austin Clark were. And you think of the wonderful blogs that are around on science, on popular science, many of them with scientists engaged in blogging are now Twittering about their science. So there is a more... there are more opportunities for a more egalitarian, democratic dissemination of science.
As I was thinking about this program and these two great popularizers, Austin Clark and Thornton Burgess, I remembered Bob Ballard's effort with the Jason Project, specifically aimed to popularize science among kids and bring an excitement with undersea exploration.
Mm-hmm. Bill Nye the Science Guy, another one.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, so there's opportunity.
Because
certainly there's interest.
There's an audience.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah, there's absolutely an audience.
Yeah.
Yeah. Christy Thornton Burgess grew up in Sandwich, as we know, but he also has a connection to Martha's Vineyard. He was part of the census on the Heath Hen there. Tell us more about the Heath Hen and why Thornton Burgess was interested in this census project.
Well, it was actually through the Radio Nature League, as I mentioned earlier. Dr. Alfred Gross at Bowdoin College, an ornithologist, biology teacher there, was doing a study on the ruffed grouse. Burgess offered his services in collecting information. Similarly to Austin Clark, there was just a connection, a personal connection between Alfred Gross and Thornton Burgess. This there was a passion for getting information, getting data, and using it, furthering it. And about the time they met, actually, Alfred Gross invited Thornton Burgess to go to Barrow, Colorado on a survey with him, extraordinary scientific experience for a layman like Thornton Burgess. He had a fabulous time, wrote about it, and got a lot of pictures. But what you're referring to, Mindy, on the vineyard, Alfred Gross was doing a survey of the ruffed grouse. The heath hen, and it was known to be an isolated population on the vineyard. So Alfred Gross would be going to the vineyard, and there was a time when the heath hen would gather in one specific location. During mating, and so it was possible to do a count, a relatively accurate count. And so Burgess participated in that, and as the numbers got smaller and smaller, tragically, Thornton Burgess wrote about the experience of holding what they identified as the very last bird.
Yeah. Unfortunately, the last bird sighted in the vineyard, 1932.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. How did you two cross paths? All right, we've got Thornton Burgess and Austin Clark who developed this friendship, and the two of you, you're studying Thornton Burgess and Marcel, you're studying. How did you two find each other?
Well, I need to jump in here because I don't even know if I've told you, Marcel, but the introduction came via Linda Hayakawa, a librarian in Tokyo at the American School in Tokyo. Yes. Yes, I was following up on a tip somebody had given me about reading Thornton Burgess in Tokyo. So I thought, well, you know, the search led me there. I thought I'll find out if they have any Burgess books in the library. In fact, they did. But Linda Hayakawa said, well, I suppose you know about the Burgess Research League, Peter Oker's Burgess Research League. And I said, no. So I looked into that. And Peter Oker said, and I suppose you know about Science on the Air by Marcel Afflalat. And I said, no. And I got the book, and it was absolutely marvelous. I really loved the way you utilize that, the initial letters, the research, the way you interpret it, the way you understood the relationship, and you saw the serious intent of Thornton Burgess, something that a lot of people over decades have missed. They've seen the stories, the adventures of Peter Rabbit, mm-hmm. and so on and so forth, and they missed that. So, you know, I'm indebted to you.
Well, that's such a nice compliment. And, of course, when I was writing the book, I would have loved to have known about Christie, because I was struggling with these letters that I'd found in the Austin Clark papers and his correspondence of a man, and all I had was Thornton Burgess's autobiography. Mm-hmm. So I was sometimes doing what historians do, putting together all sorts of different pieces of evidence and hoping that I'd gotten it right. Mm-hmm. And then we both, Christie and I, have to mention David Pawson,
yes.
and his wife Doris Pawson. David is newly retired from just this month from the Museum of Natural History at the Smithsonian. He was the successor to Austin Clark as the curator of echinoderms. Mm. He has been in touch with and gathered materials from the Austin Clark family, and Dave and Doris have pieced together more of Austin's early life, and they were wonderful in sharing with me the letters that they had that where Austin Clark was talking about his radio program, and then also then the Pawsons together with me, I think, provided Christie with materials.
Indeed.
So I want to ask each of you what's next? What are you working research now, Marcel? What are you working on?
I'm working on a biography of George Washington Ropelier, who was the man who talked John Scopes into being the patsy at the Scopes
No Oh, my.
As I was doing the radio book, I had come across negatives and photographs that everyone has sort of forgotten existed, didn't know it were in the Smithsonian, and they were restored by the archives, and I wrote a book about that, on rediscovering the Scopes photographs and about the Scopes trial. But this man, George Washington Ropelier, had a very interesting life, and I thought I'd try a biography. And I'm also continuing to work on the photographs. I'll put in a plug for the Smithsonian Institution Archives, wonderful group of people, and for, I think it's the seventh year in a row, next month, March, we will be doing again a blogging for Women's History Month, and they'll be rolling out more photographs of women scientists from their fabulous collection.
Okay, and Christie, what are you working on?
Well, in a very Burgessian way, I am promoting the book. And,
you're still working on the last
He would be proud.
Project,
I mean, yeah. I spent 4.5 years working on the research, so I'm not about to let it
sit
around.
All right. Christie Laurence, author of Nature's Ambassador, The Legacy of Thornton Burgess, and Marcel Lafollet, author of Science on American Television and A History in Science on the Air, Popularizers and Personalities on Radio and Early Television. Thank you both. Fascinating conversation. Appreciate your time.
Thank you, Mindy.
It's
wonderful.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
Amy Vince produces The Point, with assistance from Jenny Junker. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.